inflation has come in higher than expected, and bottlenecks have been more persistent and more prevalent. We see that just like everybody else does. And we see that they're now on track to persist well into next year. That was not expected. Not expected by us, not expected by other macro forecasters.
Fed Chair Jerome Powell speaking last week about rising inflation on just about everything we buy. And today, the Labor Department said prices in October were 6% higher than they were last year. It's the biggest jump in 30 years. American families are feeling it, and that is bad news for incumbent politicians, including President Biden. Joining us now is Catherine Rampell, opinion columnist for The Washington Post, where she writes about politics and economics. Hi there.
Hi.
So the highest inflation in 30 years. I assume that is because of the supply chain issue, the fact that there is an employment problem that has not fully recovered from the pandemic. Any other factors?
There are a number of factors that are contributing to these latest figures. So as you point out, supply chains are still pretty broken, meaning that because of labor shortages and other kinds of problems, it's hard to find the workers to manufacture goods, to transport goods, to put them on the shelf, to get them to consumers, et cetera. So you have that in one set of issues. Then there's the fact that demand is up for goods. People are trying to buy more stuff even than they were pre-pandemic. And that's partly because they're feeling richer. They have a lot in their bank account because of savings. It is relatively risky still to spend money on services for, you know, in-person things like travel, lodging, going to restaurants. So people have, they're flush with cash and they want to spend it on something. They're buying more stuff, whether that's a bicycle or a car or a refrigerator or what have you. So you have these shortages, and of course that's driving up prices. So all of those things are contributors, and some of that has to do with government policy, but much of it has to do with just where we are with this pandemic.
And when you say government policy, you mean that part of the pandemic assistance that the federal government put in place, giving money to a lot of Americans so they have more to spend.
Right. And obviously, that was a lifeline for a lot of families. Normally, in a recession, we expect people's incomes to go down. And the government stepped in and instead gave people more money so that they could put food on the table and they could pay their rent and, you know, pay for all of the other kinds of things that they would normally spend money on. So I'm not suggesting that that was unwise necessarily, but it does mean people have more income than they normally would when the economy was not doing very well. And now they want to spend it. And as I said, there are these bottlenecks that make it more difficult for the goods that they want to buy to reach them.
So given all that, given the fact that inflation is up, there are these bottlenecks, which are particularly frustrating around the holiday season, but Americans do have more money. The unemployment rate is relatively low. The economy added more than 500,000 jobs last month. How are Americans feeling about the economy? Because it seems like you could tell a good news story here, too.
Right. There's a lot of good things happening in the economy right now. You mentioned unemployment, job growth, stock market is doing quite well, and other kinds of economic and financial metrics look relatively strong. GDP is now above where it was pre-pandemic. We would want it to be even higher than that, but still, we've recovered a lot of ground. So on a number of different metrics, the economy looks good. But if you ask people, how do you feel about the economy right now, they're pretty down on it. If you look at figures like the consumer sentiment numbers released by the University of Michigan, or Gallup recently released a poll where they asked people to evaluate overall economic conditions and the job market. And in that Gallup poll, people were relatively buoyant when it came to questions about the job market, but they were pretty dour when asked to assess the overall economy. And that seems to reflect these price increases that they're facing, because even though the job market is strong and wages are up in nominal terms, those wage increases have not kept pace on average with the higher prices that they're paying to get gas, groceries, buy cars. So the job market's good, people are getting raises, but those raises are getting eaten away by inflation.
So, what does that mean politically? Does it mean that people are blaming President Biden? His approval rating in a recent poll is under 40%.
Yes. So I would say my standard disclaimer is that presidents get too much credit when the economy is good, too much blame when the economy is bad. Presidents do not control economic conditions. They can make policy changes that, fiddle around the margins, but they can't control how much prices are going up, for example. But that doesn't mean that the public sees it that way. And the public is generally mad about inflation and probably stands to take it out on the president. And the president is in somewhat of a difficult situation because on the one hand, if he says, hey guys, I can't control these things, then it sounds like he's being dismissive of the actual pain that many households are facing. But if he pretends that he can do more than he can, then he's setting himself up for failure. So you do see President Biden making claims like, well, if you pass the rest of my economic agenda, that will ease inflationary pressures. I think that overstates the case. There are parts of it that could be inflationary. There are parts of it that could be disinflationary, but those effects, to the extent we see them at all, won't happen for years. But in the meantime, he's saying we have it under control and my agenda will make things better because I think he feels like he has to be responsive to this very real pain and these concerns that voters and consumers are expressing. But it's challenging for him. And you will see Republicans blaming the Democratic agenda for the inflation that we're seeing. And as I said, I think it's reasonable to argue that giving families a lifeline could have contributed to some extent to the inflation that we're seeing. But for the most part, it seems reasonable to argue that the biggest factors have to do with the persistence of COVID, the Delta variant still wreaking havoc around the world. Maybe it's getting better than it was, at least in the United States, but still causing supply chain problems. So Biden has to thread that needle and respond to those Republican attacks. But again, overpromising, I think, is risky.
Katherine Rampell, opinion columnist for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, higher food prices can mean busy times for food pantries, which have already seen an enormous surge in demand during the pandemic. Now, the supply chain disruption can mean it can be harder to stock some food items. The president of the LA Regional Food Bank, Michael Flood, joins us now. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. What kinds of disruptions are you experiencing at the food bank in terms of supplies?
Well, most of what comes in is donated. So really the general rule is the farther away something is coming to us, the more disruption there is. Fortunately, a lot of our food does come in locally, especially on the donated side. A lot of fresh produce is grown here in California, so we haven't seen disruptions there. But we do purchase some of our inventory, and that's where we're seeing higher prices, some items not available, slowdowns, and with as high as the demand as food assistance has been since the pandemic hit, that certainly is causing some issues for the food bank and the agencies we serve.
What kinds of items in particular?
Well, turkeys is a good example. We've learned from previous years to order turkeys in May to make sure we're
Wow.
able to. We brought in about 20,000 turkeys this year for distribution. We certainly could use more. That's, certainly to a certain degree dependent on funding that's available, given we're a nonprofit. But, the longer you wait, especially around this holiday season, the more likely there either is going to be a delay or the item's just not going to be available. So, we've attempted to, for the purchase side, purchase early, but as we try to add on to that, as demand remains high, it's very challenging to get any of those items.
Well, talk about the demand side. we just talked about how the economy is doing better in the previous segment. What are you seeing?
I would say there's some improvement from 2020. One measurement for us is how much did food distribution increase? And in 2020, it spiked up to an increase of 145% compared to the pre-pandemic period, which is totally unprecedented for us. And now we're still more than double. We're still at a little more than 100% the pre-pandemic period. So that gives you an idea, still very high, but not as high as in 2020. So we are fortunately seeing some benefits to the economy improving.
Right. And so what accounts for this continued high demand?
Well, you know, going into the pandemic, we have very high housing costs here throughout the Southland. So this is something, you know, throughout the coastal cities on the West Coast and East Coast, you know, we see that puts a lot of pressure on the budgets for families and individuals. So that hasn't really changed much, right? From, you know, again, there's a lot around sort of housing we probably can't get into, but the overall cost of housing really hasn't changed much. We're still running a higher unemployment rate here in Los Angeles County. We're just under 10%, which, you know, based on what it was pre-pandemic, is certainly higher. And then for some who are working, they're not necessarily getting all their full hours. You know, they may be working, you know, half or three quarters time when they want to work more. Childcare is an issue. So certainly there's a lot of issues that come into play. And the other thing I want to mention, Madeline, is around these higher food prices and to your guest earlier, that hits families and individuals right away, right? So, you know, people are, you know, obviously buying food day in, day out, week in, week out. So, you know, for us, we try to get ahead of that as much as we can as a food bank. But for, again, any family or individual, they're feeling it. They're feeling it with dairy, eggs, meat items. The only items that seem to not have increased markedly is fresh fruits and some vegetables, which is good news. But, you know, for a lot of other food items, it's hitting people in the pocketbook.
And does that mean that people who normally donate a lot of food like that aren't donating as much because it just costs more?
It can. That can come into play. We're still seeing donations from the food world, retailers, and many others come in pretty strong. I think what it really means is that for some who are sort of on the edge just making it, now they're in a situation of, I need to find help. I need to either go to a food pantry or apply for the CalFresh program, what we call SNAP here locally, or find some other resource to help just fill that gap that they're experiencing in their budget.
So if people listening to this want to help, what is the best way?
They can go to lafoodbank.org. We need volunteers. We need financial support. They can search Find Food and find this network of nearly 700 partner agencies that we work with to donate there also. You know, this is a time where our partner agencies are trying to do something extra around Thanksgiving and around the December holidays. So any help can really help us stretch and reach more people as we're kind of still dealing with sort of this overall pandemic response.
And in terms of donating food, what kinds of items do you need?
Well, we need all items, but sometimes what comes into play is the handling of that food. So we certainly need produce and we need frozen turkeys and the like, but if you're gonna drop something off at a local agency, I would contact that agency first, see what they need. Usually, again, we prefer fresh and shelf-stable, but shelf-stable holiday items are needed. And I would say, by and large, that is a safe bet for most agencies that they won't have to worry about kind of the cold storage aspect of that. But we certainly need, you know, all items across the board. And agencies themselves are purchasing items, too, in addition to the donated food they receive from us or directly. So the financial contributions also go a long way.
Michael Flood, president of the LA Regional Food Bank, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
why voters are angry with their local school boards. Even progressive San Francisco Mayor London Breed has had enough. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Yesterday, San Francisco Mayor London Breed endorsed the recall of three progressive members of her city school board. She said parents are fed up that they've lost confidence in the board and are leaving the district because of how far their children have fallen behind during the pandemic. Well, this frustration with local school boards is happening across the country, and it's affecting elections. Just look at what happened in Virginia. It was one big reason why former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe lost to Republican Glenn Youngkin. So why is pandemic fury focused on school boards right now? We're going to talk about that now with Natalia Melman Petrozella. She has written a book on this subject. It's called Classroom Wars, Language, Sex, and the Making of Modern Political Culture. Hi.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Well, great to have you. First, can you weigh in on what's happening on the San Francisco School Board? Because it's not just what the mayor cited in terms of parental frustration. There were also these actions the school board took that got a lot of attention, like stripping the names of historical figures like George Washington and Abraham Lincoln from some schools because they said they were linked to oppression or historical racism, and that got a lot of blowback. So can you talk about what's happening right now with the San Francisco School Board?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that's notable about what's happening in San Francisco is that London Breed is using this language of parental frustration from the left or in an intra-left fight, right? And one of the things that we've seen in the national press is like, oh, this language of parental frustration is just kind of right-wing parents that are part of that. But I think that her invoking that and the very real frustrations of San Francisco parents show that parental anger and kind of lack of confidence in what's gone on in public schools for the last 18 months is real. And it's not just some ideological project of the right. And I mean, as you say, I think that like there's this stew of things that is coming together in San Francisco and more broadly in San Francisco, you know, really, really long school closures there. The renaming of schools, I think some people just looking at the face of it would be like, oh, well, that was a rejection of so-called wokeness or sort of excess progressivism. But what I see as a historian is one that, you know, the school board didn't consult expert historians on that. And there was some sort of questionable history that went into that process, not to mention spending time and energy renaming schools that were empty.
Yeah.
And so because they were closed for so long. And so to me, like at least those two issues kind of come together in this stew that creates the kind of rage in San Francisco that is causing this recall. But I think that kind of frustration looks different in every place, but we're seeing versions of it playing out across the country and school issues really being center stage.
And one issue that people talk about, and I just want to get your take on this, because I don't know if this is just something that is blown out of proportion on Fox News or if it is really a thing, given what we just talked about in terms of renaming the schools, is this idea of critical race theory being taught in the schools. That's a complicated topic, critical race theory, and I don't think it's being talked about in any sophisticated way in mainstream yeah. media in general. But to what extent are parents reacting to that idea?
Yeah, well, you know, I agree with the lack of sophistication around this issue. I think what's happened is that the right has been very successful and skillful in packaging a whole set of educational issues under this thing that they've presented as a very scary, right? Critical race theory is this thing where pointy-headed professors are teaching white kids to hate themselves and like sowing kind of racial discontentment in this country. And under that, they escape-grouped, all sorts of things, whether it's history that puts slavery at the center of the story, where, by the way, I think it should be just for like accuracy purposes, but they've grouped into that all kinds of like trainings and affinity group things and school renamings. And like, it's come, they've done a really good job at making that be a stand-in for a lot of things. Now, I don't think that most schools in this country are indoctrinating children with this kind of racial separatist ideology, or that teachers are intent on making white children feel guilty about the past. I absolutely do not think that that is happening. What I do think, though, is that in the last 18 months, we have definitely seen a curricular shift happen around issues of racial justice, structural inequality, et cetera. And I think that parents have been more aware of those, in part because their kids have been learning from home. And I think that when you see people on the left kind of like turn their nose up in the air and be like, what are you talking about? CRT is only taught in college. Nothing's changed. You're a racist, or you're just imagining things. They actually are doing themselves a disservice and doing education a disservice, because they're denying the fact that changes are happening in schools around curriculum and around these issues. And it might not be a law school CRT curriculum, but it is different. And that merits, you know, explanation and understanding like any curricular change. And so I think that you've got this deliberate effort on the right to make CRT seem scary and like it's taking over our classrooms. But then you have on the left, I think, a really ham-fisted way of dealing with that, of kind of like denying anything's changing. And that's just not true. And so I think the left could do a lot better on reacting to that and taking the offense, right, quite honestly.
Right. And not to mention the fact that, well, we did mention at the beginning, but just the fact that classrooms were closed for so long was really, yes, stressful for a lot of parents, and has totally put them in a sour mood. I'm just wondering, if they had open classrooms earlier, do you think we would not be having these discussions?
Oh, I absolutely think that the longer the classrooms were closed, the more kind of simmering discontent and resentment there has been. And I think that one of the reasons you're seeing like parental rights rear its head over education is because for all this time, parents were sort of told, here, go educate your kids, figure it out. We're not doing it, you know, like schools are closed. And then now that we're at a moment where parents are being told, rightly or wrongly, you don't have a say over curriculum, I think that that's a particular kind of like 180 around the expectations of parents that are rubbing a lot of folks the wrong way.
So looking at this in a political context, do you see this as, mm-hmm, just gaining more political traction as the midterms approach?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, the Republicans definitely have reason to believe that what they're doing is working and that it's a legible set of threats to, you know, a significant contingent of voters. And now we can use that to continue to discredit public education, which has been for a very long time the agenda of the Republican Party, more privatization, charters, et cetera. I don't see why they wouldn't continue down that road. And one thing that I think is really interesting that is also relevant to San Francisco is that, you know, in the Trump years, a kind of key plank of conservative educational activism kind of fell away. And that was an emphasis on rigor. Like for many decades, part of like the conservative approach or response to progressive education was like, we are the party of academic rigor. We want the three R's, all of these like softy progressives are, you know, not teaching your kids like the facts and real academics. During the Trump years, because Trump was like so aggressively anti-intellectual, they had no legs to stand on with that. So we heard almost none of that. But now you see conservatives, I think very intelligently, saying like, huh, we're pro gifted and talented here in New York. In California, we're against detracking because we believe all kids should have access to an intellectually rigorous curriculum. And, you know, whatever you think about those issues, I think that that stands to attract a lot of, you know, more center of the road voters, not like anti-CRT culture warriors who think that schools should offer that kind of differentiated curriculum. So yeah, I think that this is definitely going to stay in politics. And right now the Republicans have the upper hand in this regard, and it's up to Democrats to kind of turn it around and with all urgency make schools places that people have trust in and kind of institutions that people want to invest in and pay taxes in and most importantly send their children to.
Yeah. Is that an uphill battle for Democrats to win this back?
Well, right now it is in the immediate situation because there is this like really acute memory of closures, and schools, and particularly blue areas, are not completely back to normal. Like right now, obviously, the issue is around masking and quarantining and all that. But, you know, I don't think I'm a historian, so I know this long history, but you don't have to have such a long memory to realize that for most of recent history, Democrats have been on the side of like funding public education, like, you know, social programs, after school programs, like investing in these institutions to make them kind of more inclusive and equitable places. I would like to think that counts for something. I think one of the reasons that a lot of people in cities like San Francisco were so sort of like gut punched by what was happening in education is it seemed that the party that has long been on the side of valuing public education all of a sudden was like, yeah, literally, education isn't essential. Yeah, learning loss doesn't really matter. And that is really wild and I think sort of crazy for the party that for so long had been really the defenders of public ed as crucial to a functioning and thriving society. So, you know, I think it's totally conceivable that Democrats can revitalize that tradition, which I do think has been core to their party and their platform for a long time. But right now, it's tough.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on and putting this into context.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That's my pleasure. That's Natalia Melman Petrozella. She's a historian at the New School in New York and author of the book Classroom Wars, Language, Sex, and the Making of Modern Political Culture. Coming up, we'll tell you about a relatively obscure food gem right here in Los Angeles.
It's some of the best Thai food you can find in the country, and it just happens to be in front of this kind of beautiful Buddhist temple. And so we thought that was a really unique place, and there's some dishes there that are also kind of unusual, things like a crispy mussel pancake.
Yum, that's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A Thai food market in a temple parking lot. A secret recipe for a famous tiki cocktail. The woman who put pot brownies on the map. These are just some of the California entries included in the new book called Gastro Obscura, A Food Adventurer's Guide. It's from the same people from the online magazine and travel company Atlas Obscura. And they've compiled hundreds of pages of treats and places worth seeking out around the world to sample those treats. Dylan Thuris is co-author of Gastro Obscura, and he joins me now. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
Well, this is daunting, looking, paging through this book. Oh my gosh, you go all over the world and find all sorts of, well, frankly, bizarre, but really interesting food items and food traditions. How did you go about compiling your research?
You know, so all of this goes back to our first book, Atlas Obscura, which was basically a tour through the world's most interesting and unusual places. And Gastro started in much the same way, which is we have a big community of travelers and users of the website all over the world. And so we started by asking people to tell us their most interesting, but sort of little known or underappreciated local dishes, ingredients, fascinating, unusual restaurants. And so that sort of started the process. And we started sort of working through that material and making our own original material, writing our own articles. And then Cecily Wong, my co-author, and I then started in parallel, essentially the process of kind of mapping all of that to the world and figuring out places where we needed to dive in and do more research and find out more to try something and places where, you know, there wasn't anything or we wanted to go and add something. And so that's sort of how the whole thing began.
Yeah. And if you can't go, you can just be an armchair world gourmand.
Traveler. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And, you know, luckily, some of these things are places, right? Like the Wat Thai market in California, that's really a place. And to really get that experience, you need to go there. But there are other things that, you know, you can order online or find at a restaurant that serves a certain type of cuisine. So that's also how Cecily and I sort of did some of our research.
Well, let's talk about the Wat Thai market. It is in the Valley, and it's been there for a long time, since the 80s. Who started it?
So it's basically this Buddhist temple. And they was started by a Thai grandmother who wanted to share family recipes with people. And over the years, it started in the 1980s. And over the years, it's transformed into this kind of incredible food scene. Like it's some of the best Thai food you can find in the country. And it just happens to be in front of this kind of beautiful Buddhist temple. And so we thought that was a really unique place. And there's some dishes there that are also kind of unusual, things like a crispy mussel pancake that, you know, you might actually not be able to find in an average Thai food restaurant.
I have to be honest, I had never heard of it. And doing an informal poll of people I work with, they hadn't heard of it either. Not to say that we should have heard of it, but I grew up in Los Angeles and I haven't heard about it. So is it pretty obscure?
I guess so. I mean, I think there's an interesting thing here, which some things in the book are well known to locals. We talk about something called Malort, which is a drink in Chicago that almost every Chicagoan knows, but outside of Chicago is almost completely unknown. I wasn't actually sure in a way how well known this is, but I think now you have a good place to go and try.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm very excited. Okay, so moving on to this is something I have had, the Zombie, which is a tiki cocktail. Yeah. And this was invented by a guy named Don Beach, right? He had Don the Beachcomber, this restaurant.
That's right.
But he kept the recipe for the Zombie a secret, and he went to these extraordinary lengths to keep it a secret. What did he do?
It's amazing. So first off, this was invented in 1934, which is, I think, earlier than people might associate with kind of tiki drinks. But he's sort of considered the father of tiki. And to keep his recipes a secret, he basically, each bottle was unlabeled, but he gave it a number and he knew what those numbers meant and how to combine them. But if you walked into the bar, you wouldn't know that 2 was rum and 4 was gin. Like, so basically this was like a pretty profoundly guarded secret recipe. But in 2007, a particular fan and tiki connoisseur figured out the mystery. He found literally a little black book of coded recipes from Don Beach's restaurant. And then he figured it out. He reverse engineered. So he finally actually discovered the actual Zombie recipe. And so I love that story. I love, he knew he had something good on his hands, you know, and they're definitely, it's a kind of one drink night, I'd say. It's
absolutely.
You're good.
It involves multiple liquors.
Yes, right? Indeed.
Yikes. And then I guess multiple headaches the next day. So you also talk about food in movies in Hollywood, and you talk about Foley art, which is named after a guy named Jack Foley. And foleying is recreating sounds in movies using ordinary objects. And in your examples, you have some really interesting ones involving food. So we're going to hear a little bit and then you tell us what we're hearing. This scene is from Terminator 2 Judgment Day, which opens in a post-apocalyptic Los Angeles.
The survivors of the nuclear fire called the war Judgment Day. They lived only to face a new nightmare, the war against the machines.
Okay, so let's talk about the crunch. What is that?
So I gotta say, it ruins it a little bit when you find out what makes that sound, because it is the sound of a foot. You know, in the film, it's a foot crushing the skull. It is the sound of pistachios. It is the sound of crushed pistachios. And when you listen to it, you kind of hear it. You're like, oh, yeah, okay, that definitely could be pistachios. And it's really fun to learn this stuff. And it's a great kind of thing to share with a kid, because then they can watch films and guess at what sounds, how the sounds were made.
Okay, let's do a couple more. This one's from Jurassic Park, and this is when a baby velociraptor hatches from its egg.
Come on, then. There you are. There you are.
Oh, is that a real dinosaur baby?
Yes, that was. That was the sound of a real... No. So the sound... There's a couple of different sounds that happen in that scene. And the sound of the egg crumbling that you hear there is none other than an ice cream cone being crunched and crumbled. And again, it's kind of not... You'd think, well, why wouldn't you use just a different egg? But what I think we expect things to sound like and what they actually sound like is often really different. And it turns out that an ice cream cone sounds like a dinosaur egg to us, or it does now for sure.
Okay, well, let's hear it again.
Come on, then. There you are. There you are. Yeah.
I still don't see it as an ice cream cone, but anyway.
Who knows? Yeah, maybe there's extra audio magic.
I just want to believe in dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Okay, next, a scene from The Big Lebowski, and this is where John Goodman lifts the Lebowski guy out of his wheelchair while the dude, played by Jeff Bridges, begs him not to.
Get away from me!
Go! Oh, put him down, man!
Yeah, I'll put him down, dude!
Okay, so, what are we hearing there?
Well, there's a sound right when he picks him up, and you hear this kind of cracking sound. Uh-huh. That is not Lebowski's back actually cracking. That is a piece of celery being broken. And so celery is actually a real go-to for the sounds of snapping bones. And what's interesting is it really also depends on the vibe of the movie. So celery is almost a comical kind of cracking sound. It's not very serious. You know, in something like Fight Club, they used raw chicken stuffed with walnuts to get a much sort of more like, oh, like painful sound. And so in a way, you're adding tone and the feel that you're going for. And I think food is just like a really broad palette to play in,
so to speak. Well, let's hear that Fight Club scene you're talking about. So that's raw chicken right there, that sound.
And it's like, it's a much more unpleasant sound.
Yeah, when you think of it as chicken.
Snapping celery is kind of a silly sound, and that's kind of an upsetting sound. But this is, this is the work of a Foley artist.
Okay, well, speaking of all things California, let's talk about weed. And one of the pioneers when it came to, I don't know, feeding the world, of weed, is Mary Jane Rathbun. And she was born in 1921. And she basically took it upon herself to sell pot brownies in the 1970s, even though it was illegal to do so. Tell us more about her.
You can kind of consider her like the Mother Teresa or like the Dalai Lama of pot brownies. She got into this, when she was already in her 50s and started basically selling pot brownies on the side. She's a waitress, and she marketed them with these flyers that would call them, magically delicious and have groovy illustrations. And of course, like, the police figured this out. And so when she was 57, the police showed up and basically charged her with selling marijuana. But there was a lot of sort of sympathy, and reporters also were sort of delighted by the story. So she ended up getting community service. And during that time, she became a huge volunteer. And later in the 80s, sort of after she'd already been charged, she started volunteering with AIDS patients, and specifically making pot brownies to help with pain and nausea. She baked like 50 pot brownies every day, 1,500 pot brownies a month for these patients. She was also arrested for that, but she basically didn't care. The hospital loved her. They named her Volunteer of the Year. And she went on doing this work. She was arrested again in 92. But this is the thing, is that she was considered an absolute kind of saint and beloved by the AIDS patients and activists she worked with. And so The hospital she worked for made an official Brownie Mary Day, which is still honored. And I love that her name was Mary Jane, because it's
I was going to ask you that. Was that coincidence or did she change her name?
It's truly coincidence. I mean, the name, it is not where the name Mary Jane comes from. That comes from like Maria Juana. Like it's the similarity between that Spanish name and the word marijuana. But it just so happens that she was named Mary Jane and became kind of the Mother Teresa of pot brownies.
So there are hundreds, I think. I didn't count them all, but it seems like there are hundreds of entries in your book. Is there one that you're like, okay, I really have to go check this out?
I got kind of, it's not even a super insane one. I got kind of obsessed with a sandwich that's made in Porto in Portugal called the Francesina, or Little French Woman. And it's just sort of the most decadent sandwich in the world. It has like steak and aged ham and a linguiça sausage in it. And then it is covered in melted cheese, and that melted cheese is covered in this beer and tomato sauce, and then a fried egg is put on top. The Portuguese government actually came out and said, basically, like, hold up, everybody, only eat like two of these a month, or you're all gonna keel over. But like, man, I would like, and it's the kind of thing that like theoretically I could make a version of it for myself, but I'd much rather just wait and one day go to Porto, which is the city where it's really originated from, and get one there. So I'm like, there's a lot of things. This book left me very hungry. I'm ready to travel and eat my way across the world.
Aren't we all? Okay. Well, if we can't, we can just read your book and pretend. Dylan Thuris, co-author of the new book, Gastro Obscura, A Food Adventurer's Guide. Dylan, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to talk to you.
More food talk is on the way. Evan Kleinman is here to tell you what to do with all the different squash popping up in your grocery store these days. That's coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bit like that.
Pie.
Pie and fall. Yeah, they go together. Just like squash and fall. We're going to talk about squash season now and what to do with all of these items that are differently shaped and differently colored. With Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food. Evan, I love squash, but I have to confess I'm a little intimidated by all the different varietals.
Yeah, there's a lot of them, and they're lumpy, bumpy, giant. They're like every shape. They are intimidating.
They are, and especially when you have to open them up and take a knife to them. You really need to have, I don't know, your muscles in order.
You know what I do is I take a towel and I put it on the floor, mm-hmm. and I put... if it's a large squash on the floor, and then I take my biggest knife and I just stab it.
Gosh. Okay.
And then, cause I'm short. Uh-huh. And so doing it on the countertop, I don't have enough leverage.
Oh yeah. You definitely need the height, and you get your aggression out. So it's good.
Yeah, it is good.
I mean, it kind of looks like a head, so it could be someone's head that you're chopping, but anyway. there are, as we're saying, so many different kinds. I'm used to your acorn, your butternut.
Yeah, which are totally fine. I mean, they're perfectly sized, especially now that butternuts have been bred to have a much longer neck. It used to be that the cavity, the round bulb, took up much more real estate in the squash. Now the neck takes up more real estate, so it makes it even easier to cook with. But, you know, one shouldn't overlook the delicata, which doesn't need to be peeled. Hubbard and turban squashes are just insanely gorgeous and giant. And then kabocha, I think, has some of the best flesh. It's so dense And the color is extraordinary.
That's the green, the dark green on the outside, orange on the inside one, right?
Yeah. Sometimes it comes also in a lighter green, and sometimes you'll see them even white. But even those little carnival squash that are just all different kinds of colors, you may not even know that that's an edible squash. You might think those are just to decorate with, but no, you can use them.
Oh, okay. Well, what is the easiest thing to do with them? Roast?
Yeah, the easiest way to start is you have to cook them. And so the easiest way to cook is to roast them. And then after they're roasted, you can mash them. I also love to saute butternut squash, but we don't have to get into that. What the squash is this incredible canvas, both in terms of its kind of honeyed sweetness and that gorgeous flesh. So we should be doing a lot with it. And I think that perhaps the person who has given us the most inspiration for squash is Oda Lange.
Ah, the Israeli chef from London.
Right. Yes, the Israeli-Italian chef from London who has created an empire of restaurants and recipes. And so I just decided when I knew we were going to have this conversation to Google Oda Lange and squash just to see what came up. And it was pretty astounding, the number of recipes.
What is one of the highlights?
So I think one of the highlights is his rough squash mash with miso, chili, and cinnamon. Because what he does there is he'll do something typical, like, you know, boiling or baking and then mashing. But then just the addition of miso and chili to cinnamon already takes it somewhere else. And I think the miso adds a very welcome savory note to the sweetness that is already present.
Mm-hmm.
He has another one that's from his latest book, which is a butternut squash with chili, yogurt, and cilantro sauce. And I think that one of the greatest things he's done is give us beautiful photographs of butternut squash with these splooshes, as Jonathan would say, of like a yogurt with a little bit of chili in it. So you have that bit of white just splattered over the yellow. And then a cilantro sauce with its incredible green.
Ooh. What about for a main course?
Well, for a main course around this time of year, my mind always goes to the butternut squash and fontina lasagna I made forever at Angeli. It's a bechamel-based lasagna, so it has a bit of luxuriousness to it. But because it's just squash as the main ingredient, it isn't too rich, even though it gives you a sense of real luxury in the mouth. And then, of course, there is the whole pumpkin or whole squash stuffed. And it can be stuffed like in Dory Greenspan recipe with everything good, and which basically means hers is a strata, which is layers of bread with greens and cheese bathed in cream and broth. And it souffles up in the oven as it bakes. And the thing I have to say about these sort of marquee squashes that are stuffed is you can make them as big or as small as the squash you have. So I've actually made these main course ones using the smaller squashes like acorn squash.
Hmm. Okay, so I'm trying to visualize it. Are you taking off the top, scooping out the stringy bits and the seeds and then stuffing it, or are you cutting it?
No. You're doing exactly as you said, just like you're preparing it to be a jack-o'-lantern, except you don't want to cut out a face. And then you keep the top like a little hat and put it back on. And in the case of Dory's, you're cooking the pumpkin itself and the filling at the same time. And it becomes this extraordinary mahogany burnished, beautiful form. I mean, it's just so pretty. And then the inside has basically this savory bread pudding that often will souffle up and push the little hat off of it.
Okay, well, finally, after we've eaten our fill of squash for Thanksgiving, there's Hanukkah, which comes just a couple of days after Thanksgiving.
Yeah, and I really think we should just make latkes out of Thanksgiving leftovers.
Oh, yeah, because you've got the potatoes, probably.
Yeah,
the squash. You can make squash latkes?
yes, we can absolutely make squash latkes. You grate them just like you would grate potatoes. And I'll have a recipe for you on the website. And they're delicious and so pretty.
Well, thank you, Evan. The list of recipes is up at kcrw.com. And what is on Good Food this week?
On Good Food this week, we prepare for Hanukkah with some essential Jewish baking. And In the Weeds is very special with Lynn Ta, who is poised to reopen Here's Looking at You after closing it due to COVID in 2020.
I love that restaurant.
I know. It's so exciting.
It is so exciting. Okay. Seedlings. Things are happening.
Yes.
All right. Evan Kleiman, thank you. You can hear her show, Good Food, Saturday mornings at 11.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, that's it for us on Press Play today. Tomorrow and Friday, we have special programming for you. Tomorrow, a special episode of Life Examined. It's about workplace burnout and what you can do to try to avoid it. I'm Madeline Brand. Speaking of burned out, not really, but I'm taking a few days off and I will see you on Monday.